Welcome to Whiskey and Wildcards. I'm Vasant.
And I'm Lola. Hi.
We'll review the unofficial steampunk handbook today.
That sounds like a lot of fun and hot air.
Good summary of this podcast. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The unofficial steampunk handbook is written by Jakub Ozijewski. The last product re-reviewed by Jakub was Sleuth Squad with the Teen Detectives, but this time it is about steampunk. The handbook was published in December of 2025, so we're, well, not terribly late with this, and it's currently available on DriveThruRPG for $12.99. A bit of background about us. We played a steampunk game in Savage Worlds for 5 years.
I think so. But it's also been a couple of years since we've done that.
Mm-hmm. It was, I think, the second longer-lasting game that I was the game master for. And I think I was still, well, rather new to Savage Worlds and game mastering when I did this. So what I had back then as a bit of a guideline was Rippers, the second edition, Rippers Resurrected, and Space 1899, Red Sands.
At the time, I personally was rather new to steampunk as a genre, and I think my background was mostly more of a detective and investigation interest, coming from Agatha Christie's Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
But I really liked the aesthetics, and since then, I've become an even bigger fan of steampunk-like settings.
Steampunk-like is a good cue, because the book opens up with the different kinds of steampunk and steampunk elements and genres that might be steampunk-adjacent. To be honest, it felt like this is not real steampunk to me at first, but I think it does a pretty good job clarifying different elements of steampunk. Because if I say steampunk, it might mean something completely different than what you, for example, imagine at first or what other people would imagine. So if I just say I'm having a steampunk game, people could, for example, imagine, okay, that it's like Wild Wild West. You have giant mechanical steam-powered spiders fighting mad scientists. And someone else was maybe expecting a detective setting, and someone else would join and think, oh, it's about class struggle, isn't it? That would probably lead to a few misunderstandings. So it's great to have words for different steampunk elements here and a bit of maybe discussion what steampunk can be.
Yeah, so at the start, I was a bit intimidated because the introduction starts with what typical elements of steampunk are, but then also has a very long section about what isn't steampunk,
mm-hmm.
and then goes into all different adjacent genres. And I realized, oh, maybe some things that I thought were classically steampunk don't actually fall into this category according to this author's understanding. But this could be kind of alienating. And at first I felt like, oh, this might also be alienating to readers who have their particular idea about steampunk in mind and then are directly thrown off the wagon,
yeah,
basically.
That's not real steampunk.
Exactly. But I was positively surprised to then see that the author does cater to all of these audiences. So even though at the start he says that some genres are not technically steampunk, I felt like all of them are representable with the mechanics and the descriptions in the book.
Yeah. So I think what we played would be something like Gaslamp Fantasy.
Yeah, that's also what I thought when I read this.
Good. At least we're agreeing there after these definitions, so I think they work.
Yeah, I found this helpful. Also, as you said, to just have a language for players to get together and discuss, okay, what kind of setting do we actually want to play when we say we want to play steampunk, and what elements are interesting to us? Do we really care about the punk aspect, so like the class struggle and so on, or do we just want to have huge steam machines and science fiction?
Yeah, reading through this, I think back when we started, we had at least one player who thought that would be more Magitek.
Mm-hmm.
Others played Investigation with a Gaslamp setting, and there were also fans of Gaslamp Fantasy, so, or Steampulp maybe. And I think it took some time to get on one page.
If we ever managed that, to be honest. But let's not get into those details.
Let's just imagine that we played this for a while and were really on the same page and had a lot of fun.
It was a learning experience.
But this would have helped.
Absolutely, I agree. Yeah.
But as you said, although the author comes across as, that's not real steampunk, I think what this book evolves to is, oh, so you like screampunk? Oh, that's fine.
Yeah,
then
exactly.
Take this for your setting. I never heard of screampunk before, by the way.
Oh, there were a lot of subgenres that I hadn't heard of before.
Dishonored was there as well as City Weird. I always thought there was whale punk because everything is powered by whale oil. Apparently, there's more than Dishonored in this kind of setting where the city itself is a source of absurdities and magic and stuff. What was funny to me is that after all this definition about what steampunk is, it continues to Volsung, which is, I don't know, steam fantasy?
Yeah, I was also a bit surprised by that. I hadn't heard of Volsung before. And my expectation was like after this introduction, okay, so now you're going to give us the absolute prototype of a steampunk setting. And then there were a couple of pages on dragons and elves and dwarves. And I was like, is this still the same book? But I think I understand what the author is doing here, namely to show that the aspects that characterize steampunk do not necessarily require a London in the late 19th century or something. It matters in steampunk, according to Jakob, seems to be more a combination of class struggle and industrial revolution. And this can also happen in a world that contains elves and dwarves. And this also captures this idea of this inclusive catch-all companion to steampunk settings, where basically you can do whatever you want, and here are rules to make it more steampunk.
Mm-hmm. I personally am not terribly interested in the kind of setting that Volsung is, so I don't have many notes to the parts of the book that are about Volsung.
Yeah, neither do I. If I personally think of steampunk, I would also probably not like to play a fantasy-inspired setting then. I'm really more of the London in the late 19th century type. But it's nice to see that this is possible as well.
It also seemed that like this is already a huge setting and I just missed all of it.
But it's for a different system, right? What is it exactly? I haven't heard of Volsung before. Do you know anything about it?
No.
Okay. That's fine, I guess.
As far as I know, the Volsung is its own thing and it has its own rule book, so I don't think it's for Savage Worlds originally.
It appears like you can also access this rule book from the Steampunk Handbook. So if you're interested in that, it might be worth checking out.
Mm-hmm. When we made up characters for the steampunk game back then, one thing that I thought would be relevant were all these social classes that were much more separate than in maybe a more modern setting. And back then, when I was new to Savage Worlds and GMing, I wondered how to do that. Do I need rules for that? And both Rippers and Space 8089, both by Pinnacle, they were like, yeah, you absolutely do. So here are charisma rules back then. In the old times, there was still charisma and extra rules additionally to charisma rules for status. So if I remember correctly, with a higher status, you get a bonus on intimidation, while a lower status would get a bonus on taunt.
Oh, yeah, I remember
and
that.
Then it would take into account the difference between the status values of the one you're speaking to or trying to taunt or intimidate. There are also extra rules for, I think, favors that take your status into account. And this opens up with, yeah, well, by the way, I don't like these rules. And after having played these, I think this is the right call.
I think that's absolutely fair. To be honest, in our game, even though we had these rules, I don't remember how exactly you established them or how effective they were for our campaign. But I felt like even though they were theoretically present, they didn't have much of an effect on the relationships between the characters and on how they interact with the world.
Yeah, that's doubly bad, isn't it?
Yes,
so you have extra mechanics, but they don't do anything for the world.
I agree.
Of course, it might just be that I misunderstood them and didn't apply them correctly. But for me, that just seemed like overhead and also often didn't translate into the situation we were in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they were also not very flexible.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think does the steampunk book do this better?
Well, it just flat out tells you that you shouldn't do these rigid mechanical bonuses for one particular skill according to the status, but just take into account the specific situation and then use appropriate bonuses for that. That might be a bit harder for a new GM because they don't know what an appropriate bonus is, but you always have a ballpark of bonuses and penalties. And of course, if you think that it's not interesting mechanically right now, then you don't have to put on bonuses and penalties on it. Savage Worlds does work like that. You don't need to plus 0.5 on a roll or the system just collapses.
Yeah, exactly. And this is actually one of the reasons why I really enjoy playing Savage Worlds, because it is, in theory, able to cater to many different situations and provides some flexibility that these bonuses, when they are used in such a stringent, rigid way, don't seem to deliver.
And another good idea, in my opinion, are the origins.
Yeah, that's another thing that I wanted to ask you, how they would work or how you think they translate, because I'm not sure. Is there anything like this in the original Savage Worlds rules? Or is this an add-on?
No, this is just how ancestries would work. So a human would get the one free talent, and a dwarf would get, I don't know, a bonus on strength or something, and an elf would have innate magic or whatever would fit in the setting. So it's just this starting bonuses that are applied here to your social origin.
But it seems to offer both, doesn't it? It doesn't just have social origins.
It also has these, I don't know, dwarves and elves and stuff.
Exactly.
If you have them in your game.
That also counts as ancestries. I wasn't sure if they were just treated in the same way or not.
I think so, yes.
Okay.
And it's a huge selection for different social classes and a lot of ideas and archetypes that you would expect. And I think a lot of archetypes that I didn't expect.
Yeah, it's a really interesting selection. It was categorized after three different classes. So you can have a background in the lower classes, middle class, and upper class. And it already provides some inspirations for what kind of backgrounds fall into these three categories. So, for example, obviously, an urchin would be a lower class character. But to my surprise, also a policeman would fall into the lower class.
Yeah, the ones on the street, right?
Right. And I think that's historically plausible, but I just didn't expect it. And then for middle class, you have like business people, teachers. So people who work for their money, but do have some money, do have some education. And then for the upper class, broadly people who don't have to work for their money and who just spend their time with interesting and expensive hobbies like academics, adventurers, hunters, scientists, politicians. It sounded a bit discouraging that the author suggested to ban players from playing characters with an upper class background in a proper steampunk campaign.
Steampunk, yeah.
Steampunk,
yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it depends on your group and your players, I guess. But I feel like for creative and experienced players, playing upper class characters could actually add to the tension between the classes and to the class struggle idea of the steampunk setting. And character ideas that I instantly had in mind were, for example, a doctor would, like a physician who would count as upper class, but who is inspired to devote themselves to humanitarian interventions by helping, for example, street urchins or whatever, because they see how they suffer on the streets, and then they have to balance their upper class peer group and their drive to help the lower classes. Or maybe a rogue politician who maybe originally pretends to be in favor of socialist policies, but then through some experience actually sides with lower class workers, or similar ideas. I thought there was a lot of potential there, and simply not allowing those characters in a campaign that tries to address the social struggle seemed a bit too strong, maybe.
I think that depends on how you would address this struggle. If you would more discuss it between the players and player characters and share your different experiences, or if it would be more you as the people rising up against the social norms, against very powerful people in the upper classes, who of course want to keep the status quo. And we get into that later when it's about villains and antagonists. But if you have this class struggle in a more dystopian and gritty kind of way, where it's hard to rise up against these powers because first they have the power and then they don't care about you as an equal human. And that is what causes this divide and makes it so hard. I think that depends on the way you want to present the setting and how you would address that in your game. So if you have a general eat the rich game, then it probably made sense not to include the rich and the player characters, right?
It depends. There are also real life people who technically belong to the rich who side with people who want to eat the rich. And I personally think that this could make it more interesting. But I feel like you're right to say that not every character should be an upper class character for this to work. So the core of the group should definitely be directly affected from oppression by higher classes.
If you want to do it like that, if you are more in the steam pulp kind of genre, for example, or investigations and these sort of things, then the class struggle might be something that's not completely central to your setting. Well, it's a part of the setting, of course, but maybe it's not your job or not your aim to change the world in terms of social classes. So back when we played a steampunk game, or back when we started to play a steampunk game, we had a mix on these social classes among our characters that had some funny moments when one player who played a lower class worker was questioning, why can't I have all these expensive things? Why do I have to work for it? And these other player characters who played rich persons, they just can either have it or buy it with a pocket money. And they say, yeah, this is how the setting is supposed to work, right? This is why this is unfair. And because we had this mix, we had rich player characters who could just bankroll stuff like an expedition to somewhere or buying someone a boat. And that was really handy for adventurer purposes. But also, I think it emphasized how these unfair societies might turn out. I mean, of course, this is a really tame example of that. I think that's not what we focused on the game.
Yeah, exactly. I felt like in our game, yeah, we mixed characters with different social backgrounds, but these social backgrounds rarely played a big enough role to manifest noticeable distinctions between the characters in that sense. So I feel like if we would have wanted to play it more in the way that Jakub seems to visualize a real proper steampunk punk campaign, it would have already been difficult for our characters to justify spending time with each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there were definitely some interesting aspects of these differences.
I think the punk part of the setting is really supported by the way the book is laid out and illustrated, because it looks like some kind of like a zine. Right? Like a fan-made publication by someone who glued it together and shared this with her friends.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if I should like the presentation or not. Also, especially the language and the way it presents itself. So it uses a lot of slang or maybe at times also swear or slur words.
Well, I think most of the time when it's used, it is censored
again, right? It's censored, yeah. Which I'm not sure if it makes it better or worse, but yeah, so first of all, I got the impression that the author was really taking his freedom with the book, which is absolutely fine. I kind of understand all of this as an offer, a take it or leave it offer, basically. And I think it's fair to present it like that. Secondly, it adds to the punk atmosphere that it's supposed to create. But at times I found it a little challenging to read or to think about it in a way which I primarily like to think about these kinds of books, namely as informative and maybe a manual more than a pamphlet.
Yeah. I see. Yeah, the vibe that it gives off is definitely more punk rock than Jules Verne.
Oh yeah, that too. Absolutely. That's also a different type of genre, as we learned.
Yeah, it's more retro science fiction.
Retro science fiction, yeah, thank
because
you.
They didn't intend it to be steampunk. To support all these options, the book offers new edges and hindrances, as it is often the case. Also introduces artist as a skill, a bit like performance, but for art that isn't performed, basically, which I think it fits in really well. The different languages are specified and how they would be used in what circumstances, that was, I think, really useful. A lot of the hindrances seem very interesting to me to also use in a general setting, not necessarily steampunk. A lot of good ideas in there, I think, and didn't feel like bloat.
Yeah, I felt like both the hindrances and the edges that were introduced could definitely also add some interesting flavor to other settings, not just to a steampunk setting.
And I think that continues into the setting rules as well.
Yeah. So the author presents a whole list of existing setting rules that he simply adjusts in a minor way, or maybe not even at all, to fit the steampunk setting. I find this a really good idea, basically to recycle what is already there and show how it can be put to use in a steampunk setting.
Or in other settings. Or I think there are some recommendations depending on what kind of settings, what flavor you're going for. But also has some new setting rules that support some steampunk conventions or scenes. For example, that a masked Avenger would always have a great cloak.
Yeah, I like the cloak thing. it's similar to take a leg.
From Buccaneer,
Where instead of taking lethal damage, your formidable, huge, wavering cloak is destroyed.
And that's why you need a cloak.
Right.
It makes sense.
It also, it's really expensive to get such a cloak. It has to cost £1, which is about, if I remember correctly, 100 euros roughly, or dollars in current currencies.
I think it is 100 of the Savage Worlds dollars
or they use. Like in the Savage Worlds dollars, exactly. So especially for lower class characters, not so easy to get.
Yeah.
And I think this also, again, marks the differences between the classes very well, because basically as a higher class character, you can simply buy your health by buying a cloak.
Yeah. But I think that supports certain genre tropes or certain parts of the setting.
Yeah, absolutely.
The people with big cloaks, or police officers who don't carry guns.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's one setting rule called flashing blades that makes extras with guns less efficient.
Yeah, I really like that.
When they're in close combat. So I think that really makes sense, especially in pulp.
There was also the setting rule called servants.
Oh, yeah.
Which sounded really funny, but could also potentially contain some potential for a conflict. Because if I remember correctly, it works as follows. Every player character, or most player characters, have a servant. And the servants are, again, played by other player characters.
You mean by other players?
By other players, exactly. And the idea behind this is also that the servants among themselves speak badly about their employers or try to get back at them.
That's such a fun idea.
That's really funny. But I feel like in groups where there are players who are sensitive to player versus player conflicts, this could also result in a difficult atmosphere.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you don't have to be an ass to your servant, do you?
Right. But I felt like this was kind of the idea of the setting.
Okay, yeah, maybe. There are also extra rules for social conflicts and romantic endeavors. What do you think of them?
Can I ask you something as my primary GM?
Sure. Go ahead.
Because I was wondering if from the effects that are described for both the, what was it? Like one thing was the rocking and the other one was the seduction.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe also social conflicts in general. I don't remember that if there was a table for that.
So rocking is a setting rule for getting people behind you with music.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So definitely for rocking and for seduction, I felt like good results were comparably easy to get. But maybe that's just because of my personal frustration with social conflicts in campaigns that I play with you. I don't know, but it seemed like both in the seduction table as in the rocking table, only if you have zero successes, you basically don't take away anything positive.
But these are the social conflict rules.
Right.
So this is the exact same as in the core game with social conflict.
Right. Then maybe you just interpret them a bit meaner than they're described here. But maybe that's also just me.
Okay. So did you compare just with the game or with the social conflict rules as written?
I didn't check the social conflict rules written. So I just compared it to my personal experiences.
Yeah. But just to get back on this, there are rules for having punk rock or whatever music you want to do, concerts in a steampunk setting. That's not what I'd expected. And it even has two ways you can do that, either by just making music for an audience or making music for a political message. And back when I saw this in Sleuth Squad, I was already surprised that it was in there, was really delighted. And now it is in here again, and I'm again, for some reason, surprised. And again, I'm pleasantly surprised. I did not expect that in a steampunk setting, but I think that fits right in. I can imagine that in a steampunk setting, and if you don't want to use it, then you don't have to.
Yeah, I was also surprised by that, because when you think of steampunk, well, I mean, there's obviously punk in the name, but still, a punk rock band is probably not what you picture. At the same time, the author also writes, it doesn't have to be steam-powered electric guitars and a drum set, but rather the rock stars of the time were like big composers, like, for example, Paganini. I was interested, I have no clue about the historic Paganini or Liszt or whoever else the author mentioned, and I was wondering if they were actually politically involved or not. Do you know anything about this?
According to the game, I would probably be lower class and have no academic interest in music.
Fair.
No, I don't know about these composers as political figures. No idea.
But other than that, I also imagined, I mean, this is obviously a bit different time, but I also immediately pictured something like Les Misérables or something. They start a revolution and they have all these revolutionary songs and chants to get the people on the street and to unite them and so on. And I thought that this would also fit the setting very well.
Yeah, true. Could be a musical setting if you want.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, I think this would work well. I also didn't expect it to be part of a steampunk handbook, but I think there are really ways to use it in an interesting and fitting way.
As soon as you come up with an explanation for steam-powered guitar. Otherwise, we have to call it galvanic guitar and then it works.
Sure.
Another mechanic I did not expect was clacking. I mean, I've read the difference engine. I know that a part of steampunk are these big computer-like calculation machines.
So the underlying idea, or one of the drivers behind steampunk, is also this what-if scenario, right? That the author also addresses. What if something like the difference engine would have actually been built? So a calculating machine that is powered only by steam and gears, but which, if sized adequately, could be able to calculate similar to old small computers or something like that.
Yeah.
And the clacking mechanic in the steampunk handbook allows then for hacking these kind of systems, which I thought was a really cool idea, and I was really inspired by that. I immediately thought about ways to get into these huge machines, and the author also says that obviously for steam-powered mechanical computers, hacking doesn't simply require you to find some problem in the code and to take advantage of that, but also a lot, I mean, probably also for other kinds of hackings, but especially in the setting, a lot of social engineering, a lot of thievery, breaking and entering and meddling directly with the hardware and the gears of the system.
Yeah. I was really surprised either how much thought went into this.
Absolutely,
how much research Jakob did with the thought, how would you hack or clack such a machine and what could you do? And the idea of having some kind of crank that brute forces through all the inputs, or listening to the mechanism itself of the machine. So you know, if you, for example, want to put in a password, when the right combination clicks in and when it doesn't, that you can overheat the machine to block it. The only thing that I paused to think about a bit, there were really steep penalties on decoding and modifying, depending on the higher security levels. So you get into modifiers like -6 or -8, which is a lot. And this is maybe a topic that gets addressed a lot, especially in hacking. I don't know why, but to be fair, this is the same ballpark that the official Savage Worlds Science Fiction Companion uses. So it's in line with that. So I think it's a good idea to do it similarly for the same system. So even if I think these are very steep, they are very close to the official companions.
But couldn't you also get around this by investing more time and resources? So I remember, for example, that there were these thinking machines, which cost a lot of money, but could, with enough time, help you decode data or whatever. So I felt like if you don't want to do this on the spot and you have a lot of time and you can, for some reason, maybe because you're upper class, invest the money.
You have these modifiers and money and time.
Right.
And you can work 50 times slower without building such a machine to decode
yes.
it. So if you need 20 hours, you can say, okay, I don't care. I have 1,000 hours.
Right.
But in most settings, you probably need the results of your clacking.
That's true.
Rather immediately. You don't want to plan what the evil steampunk empire does in a few months, right? You need them now to stop them.
Depends on the kind of campaign that you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
But what I also liked, and maybe this can be connected here, are these rules for having a club or having...
like a headquarter or a meeting.
A headquarter or a shelter
place, yeah.
or something like that you can get back to with your group where you have your stuff, your organization, and can be anything. So club is not necessarily the best way to describe it because it can also be the afternoon tea house for the knitting grandmas or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or
really a killer concept for a player character group, by the way.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so these clubs can be anything and they can have a lot of features. And so I feel like if this is what you're interested in your campaign, why not have a place where you can have your thinking machines thinking and get your data decoded while engaging in more immediate things.
Something like the Chaos Computer Club.
Exactly,
where
yeah.
The Clacker Kids hang out.
Right.
Sorry, the Chaos Clacker Club, of course. I really like these headquarter or base
yeah.
rules. It got pretty usual in Suede, I think, because all the official companions have some sort of headquarter or base building rules in them. And I really like that because in nearly all of my campaigns, this is something that I would use or would like to have. I think this goes back to Rippers, actually, which...
Mm-hmm.
For Savage Worlds came up with that, with the lodges. I think the first Rippers, it was still tied to money a lot. So you have to buy your upgrades and buy bonuses. And this one doesn't do it. There's no bookkeeping for money, which is fantastic. Because I don't think that works really well in role-playing games where you have a lot of flexible time, a lot of leeway, and it's not really mechanic. So either you want to explain what brand of noodles your player character buys and how that factors into the budget he has for, I don't know, buying an airship for the next adventure. And I didn't want to go there, right? I was there a lot. It was not fun.
Yeah, instead, the clubs simply can have one or more complications. For example, the base is falling apart. It's old, poorly built. Or also maybe that it's shady, the club is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this gets rid of the bookkeeping in a nice way that still keeps it interesting. So because you still have to deal with problems that could arise surrounding your club, it's not just like a free space that you can go to whenever you please and all amenities that you need are already there, but you have to take care of it and it might get you into trouble,
yeah.
Financial or social or whatever.
Into adventures.
Into adventures, of course. Like travel's always adventures. That's how it works, right?
Yeah. I like a lot how this plays into the adventures or basically the story of the player characters. And it's not like, okay, we looted the criminal aristocrat so we can buy, I don't know, a garage and have a +2 on driving. And that's it. You know,
yeah.
It's purely mechanical and purely detached from the story
yeah.
that you create as a group. And having all these details about your club, having to care for it in a way or having it play into your story is really enriching the whole thing, in my opinion.
Yeah, the only thing I didn't necessarily like was that you roll for these things. So the way the rules are presented is that you randomly assign an advantage, a complication, the things that your club offers and so on, which I'm not necessarily a fan of because depending on what your group does and what your campaign and setting actually really look like, this might then fit better or worse. I didn't check for internal consistency. They probably all work together in some way, I would expect. But still, I personally think it's nicer to talk about these things and simply try to find a balanced version. But I mean, it obviously doesn't force you to roll on these things. And it offers a lot of funny and interesting ideas for features of your club.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I sadly remember from my first vantages into GMing a steampunk game is inventions. Because one of the players played an inventor and he wanted to invent steampunky gadgets.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's fine. I mean, that fits really well into the whole setting. I really like that. So I was looking for mechanics to basically make that possible. I didn't want to make it harder for anyone. I don't want to force anyone to roll, but I was looking for mechanics that made it interesting for the player to do this without giving them free stuff that makes it unfair or makes it too easy. And also maybe takes away any drama you might have. Because steampunk inventors, they're of course all crazy. They have prototypes that fail all the time. So you want to have this in there in some way, I thought. And back then, I looked at the invention rules in Space 8089, which were, how to put this? I think they were bureaucratic. They weren't really fun. It was more like, I don't know, getting a grant for a prototype and draw it and then get it built by a small company or something. So there was really involved. There was a lot of rolling. There was a lot of bookkeeping. And in the end, it wasn't really like fast, furious and fun, you know?
Yeah.
In here, we have two possible mechanics. You have the weird science one, where you have weird science that people might not understand, but you do. And you have all these small gadgets that work like an arcane background. And the other thing are inspired inventions, which you can have parallel to weird science in your setting. In that case, there are a few adjustments. Or it is in a full alternative and replaces the weird science. And the way this is presented, I think, it looks really fun. You can't do it in downtime. You have a major hindrance while you're working on it. And then you draw cards. And I really love that because usually you draw cards from a poker deck. But in this mechanic, you actually put down poker combinations.
Right.
And you draw combinations and the highest combination wins. And then it basically describes what's happening, how long it takes, how much of an ace prototype your invention is. If someone can just build it by a blueprint, or that it's just a thing that you built and you didn't even draw blueprints, you just worked and now it works and you can't probably explain why it does. This is really wild.
Yeah, it sounded like a lot of fun and an interesting idea. I think it's good that this is a bit limited. So since you have this major hindrance and so on, it's not something that can happen every session or that can happen all the time. I feel like this makes it seem also because it has these card drawing rules and so on and effects that are really nicely described. It feels like a highlight that happen occasionally when you have inventive characters in your campaign. Yeah, which I think it should be because it really means that you're inventing something ingenious and weird, ideally.
Yeah. So talking about technology and inventions, the book uses, especially for the equipment, a kind of tech level.
Yeah, I really like that idea. It distinguishes between three levels, steam levels. At the zero level, the zero steam level, you basically have only minor gadgets. It's quite similar to the historic Victorian age. At steam level one, you can have technical artifacts that are similar to modern day technology, if I remember correctly, but steam powered.
Yeah.
And I also liked the way that the author described how to translate modern day technologies into steam powered technology, namely simply by making them more clunky, making them huge, making them loud, big, impractical, maybe even dirty. But it's theoretically possible to have a steampunk powered smartphone or something like this. Probably a bit harder to carry it around and will not have as many use cases as our smartphones, but it's theoretically possible.
To be fair, these things get huger and huger by each generation.
That's true.
And depending on where you bought your pants, they might not fit in there anymore. So we might get there.
At steam level two, you could also get what we would now consider as science fiction technology, just also steam powered, like crazy drone weapon systems, AI, obviously, and space travel, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which kind of also sounds like modern day technology, but think of more science fiction. And this is kind of the underlying categorization for the tech level in the world. The book refers to this at a couple of places, and I think it's just a really helpful idea to discuss this maybe when starting a campaign. Like, what kind of tech level do we want to see in our campaign? What should be possible? Yeah, what technology is like commonplace for our characters? What are they used to? What can they do? What could also be a weird invention? And so on. And all three sound interesting in their own way.
Yeah, again, this is a great way to make clear what kind of setting you're going to apply. Like the setting elements at the start that we talked about, you have clear examples for these tech levels and can get on one page with your group. So I have this note here about equipment that is available, and it ranges from walking sticks to brain extractors. So really depending on what level you're going there. There's even a kind of steampunk equivalent for cyberware from, you know, cyberpunk settings as steampunk prosthetics, if you want to go there. And I liked how they had these tips to have multi-functions in your equipment. Like, you have a walking cane that has a hidden blade. And especially if these functions are useless, they really add to this quaint, fidgety vibe of the setting sometimes.
Right.
People are just inventing stuff because they can. And it's like, no one asked for this.
That's a funny way to think of it.
And it has gears. It also goes into detail again about difference engines, the computers you already talked about. And the detail the author went into here is really astonishing because, well, it just makes sense. It checks out, but it's something that I wouldn't think about initially. For example, how to power the thing. Like, do you have a boiler or like a crank you have to crank? Or do you have some kind of bicycle you can just ride on and then produce the energy that this machine needs?
Another question is also how to store data in there, which I thought was also really, really interesting and really well thought through. And the author offered many different options how data could be stored in your setting, depending on what flavor of steampunk you prefer. So I think his preferred choice is to put everything on vinyl discs, which I think matches more of a classic Victorian steampunk setting very well.
Or just punch cards, right?
Or punch cards, yeah, exactly. But then there were also suggestions such as biological data storages, which could, for example, be data stored in the DNA of reptiles because they can regrow their limbs and therefore this is particularly sustainable or whatever.
Again, I don't know if Jakub comes up with this by himself or just has made a lot of research, because I read some steampunk fiction, I played some steampunk games, I watched some steampunk movies and stuff. I never heard of these things.
Yeah.
This is super wild. Also, there's a section about chemistry in steampunk. If I think about our steampunk crew, we had one chemist in there.
Right.
She would really have a field day or field campaign there. But again, this is more fantastical with Hidium, for example, by Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, it's a bit more alchemic than chemistry. Yeah. Although one aspect that is stressed a lot in the book is that science and especially medicine really had a breakthrough in the historic era in which steampunk usually takes place. And this also plays an important role here. So it's not just fantastical alchemist style chemistry, but I think the idea is also to embed it into a science-driven worldview.
Yeah, I think this is a bit of the point that all these weird sciences are things that the people who would research it and use it think is hard science.
Right, exactly.
And not as magic or, you know, you wouldn't get it. The equipment section also goes into detail about vehicles. And I think it covers pretty much everything from more historical kind of vehicles in there to fantastical and more outlandish ones, all with stats to drop them indirectly if you need a car or an airship or something. Also, a good GMing tip, I think, if you play a setting which is about airships, then your player character group should get a free airship, basically, and not, you know, have to buy their first airship to get it going. Similarly to like a pirate campaign where you should have some kind of ship. Doesn't have to be the greatest and most expensive one, but you have to have one of these iconic vehicles to take part in the action. Otherwise, it's not a pirate game if you sit on an island and just wish for a ship. Sorry, am I dissing the...
I was about to say that. It depends who you ask, I guess. Last time we reviewed A Pirate Campaign, which is exactly doing that. They don't have a ship and they sit on an island and still have adventures. No, but I generally share your point.
For everyone that isn't Rudolph.
I share your point. I definitely agree that if the point of your campaign is experiencing air travel, it doesn't make sense to have a player group that has absolutely no access to air travel. So
yeah, if you want to play a crew of an airship and be sky captains and stuff, not fly around and just have adventures on a place you arrived at, that's fine as well. Then you don't need an airship.
Yeah,
it's just a thing that you have to make clear in that way. And if you have an airship or, I don't know, a steam-powered car or anything, and if you're more interested in filling with it, there's also a list, again, similarly to the Science Fiction Companion, about upgrades you can do to your vehicle. Like, you can tinker with it, you can invest time and money in it to have certain new features of it. And I think this is very steampunky as well. Usually I'm not that much into the whole gear catalog thing where people try to get together most bonuses for their buck, but having an airship and then having your mechanic or inventor tinker with it every game, this feels really typically steampunky to me.
And can I just say, I don't think it was in the vehicle section, but I really appreciate the pun of the infernal combustion engine.
Where was that?
It's under opponents, oh, okay. Actually, and about the objects and things that they can be or have. But also, in general, a great upgrade for your vehicle, an infernal combustion engine. I'm
sure.
A big fan.
There's also a chapter about arcane backgrounds. And I was afraid that this was the part where I was skipping through and dozing off, because it would mainly be about steam fantasy and Volsung, which is not especially my type. But then it came up with all these arcane backgrounds that fit so well into most of the steampunky settings that I would play or enjoy. The occultist, for example, or the mad chemist, the biomanipulator, which is basically Frankenstein, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Dr. Frankenstein. It feels like this is very experimental medicine. Yeah, I don't know what I can add about the magnetist. This is so this epoch or this time. Really, really cool. The medium, to get back to our game again, we had someone who was more on the occult side. And when I saw that there were these arcane backgrounds, I was wondering, if I had known this book, would this have solved the issues that came up when we tried to get that in on our own? And it would have.
Mm-hmm.
There was the whole question about how do you, as someone who is researching arcane or occult happenings, how would you use Detect Arcana, like the power for it? And if you play a medium, then you can have that as a reaction role.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to state, okay, I will use my Detect Arcana power now and look through the room. Is there anything arcane here? And the GM says no. And then you go on. So it's like doing your perception role by yourself every room, which is something I don't want.
I also found this idea of the Metropolitan really cool. In general, this is a theme that comes up at several points in the book, that some steampunk subgenres have this focus on cities. And in general, the steampunk genre has often a focus on systems.
Like political and societal systems? Or?
Both, but also mechanical systems.
Oh, yeah?
And their relations. And the Metropolitan, as I understood it, is somebody who takes their arcane power from the city itself. And the city is kind of also this arcane, or maybe even in some way living being, that has become kind of more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
Which I found was a really cool idea and is also really well thought through. I found this really inspiring and could visualize it really well, where, you know, we have all these steam engines, all these chimneys, and somebody who can really interact with these things, because everything is also connected through tubes. And yeah, it's just become its own power source for magic.
Yeah.
I find this a really cool idea.
A fantastic idea. There are a few new powers which I thought fit in well and were really helpful. Having the ability to magically repair things makes so much sense in a setting which is about steampunky, clunky inventions that might break down or erupt in flames if you don't operate them correctly. Also, there are examples or ideas for different artifacts, which each of these artifacts is like a whole plot idea. Really, really cool. So, in contrast to the expectations I had for Arcane Backgrounds in a steampunk handbook, this delivered really well, and I'm all in all impressed by it. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's really nicely made.
There's also material about how to create your world or the setting together and how to GM in such a game, which I found generally helpful to talk about what is the hook of your steampunk world, mm-hmm. if it has any, what should the game be about? And is it connected to the hook, so the thing that makes your game special? This is a good thought to not have this to be connected, because if the hook is why you play it, then you can play it once and then, for example, your setting secret is unveiled and the game is over or it's not interesting anymore because then you finished the setting.
Right. The world building section also really nudges you to think of the campaign or the world more in terms of themes rather than of particular people, particular places or whatever.
Mm.
So rather than asking who is the villain by are they evil, ask what is the underlying tension in this world that you're making. Like, for example, is it about secrets or is it about inequality or something like this? And then these themes can be filled with places and people. And I really like this idea.
Yeah, and it goes on from this abstract level of what is the idea or your motive of your game to very detailed stuff like why the steam or clockwork machines are more practical than they were in history, and an overview about alternatives of technologies you have now in your modern life and alternatives that you might have in a steampunk setting. There's a whole idea of a telegraph internet thing in mm-hmm. this book, which I found really exciting, which you don't have to include, of course, but it's really helpful, I think, to have these equivalents and alternatives in writing somewhere.
And next to technology, what I also really liked was, again, this idea of the system and that the punk theme also works best if the system is kind of to blame and the system is evil and you're not fighting a particular person rather than you're fighting the whole, like you're fighting capitalism itself or something like that. But then again, the author says that you should also give the system and its particular parts a human face to make it interesting for the place. And I think this is a really cool and good idea to think about it, that on the one hand, it's not about the villain.
Mm-hmm.
It's about this whole structural problem that the player characters are facing. But of course, within the structure, there are individuals that will probably be reoccurring and that might make quite interesting villains on their own, but they could also be replaced. And mm-hmm. this might also keep the campaign going. I like this idea.
Yeah, me too.
The world building part also contains sections about particular cities that could provide inspiration for a steampunk world or a steampunk setting.
This is something that I feel has become a bit of Jakob's style, to have these places with all the details and history.
Okay.
That was similarly made in Sleuth Squad, where I like this way of presenting an area or a place very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also liked it here. There are like a couple of different cities all around the world. Paris, Warsaw, St. Petersburg, Berlin, obviously London, of course. Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to do this in London.
Right.
There were great ideas in there that don't have to be like the trope of London in some form. And you could still have a steampunk campaign in there, but it might have a completely different flair.
Right. And again, I also really like that here, Jakob also sorted to every city particular themes mm-hmm. that played a role or that could be interesting hooks for a campaign playing there, where, for example, if you play in Warsaw, then one of the themes is the struggle of East versus West, that it was a city, or maybe to a lesser degree, probably also still is, that is both part or like influenced strongly by Russia or by Eastern Europe, but also for Eastern Europe counts somehow like the gate to the Western world mm-hmm. and something like that. And it's an identity, it plays a big role there and so on. And then for St. Petersburg itself, themes were more like the Tsar and this dictatorial or autocratic, at least, system that everybody is watching. And there is conflict and intrigue and stuff like that. And I really like this because it directly gives you a feel for not just the place, but also the social structure and the kind of problems and conflicts that could arise.
Yeah, and I found this really excellent, not just by the amount of information that is in there, like the historical background, the motives, the research into slang,
yeah,
and stuff like that. Because if you're learning out about either a historical place or a place that you made up, it might just happen that you produce a lot of detail around it.
Mm-hmm.
But one factor that I feel is often overlooked is that someone else has to grab all that, right?
Yeah.
And if I want to have a setting, I don't necessarily want to read 200 pages about it and read about historical background of it when I don't know if it's relevant at all, and maybe it isn't. So what I'm really impressed by is not just that he covered all these things, both the historical background and all these details, and putting that into themes that can work in your game, but also how compact this all is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. It's only a couple of pages for each of these places, and it works really well.
Yeah, there's so much in there. It's so hard to be short and then convey all this information and vibes and flair.
Yeah.
And I think he did that really well with all the examples that are in there in a way that I would usually expect this as an add-on to an existing setting or something like that.
Yeah, I felt even a bit sad that I don't usually play in English-speaking groups, because for the London part, there's really so much about language as well, which I think really conveys the atmosphere of the place really well. So the author included these Cockney expressions, but also I think somewhere else when it's about the classes, he speaks about how traders invented their own slang to conduct maybe also semi-legal transactions and so on.
Yeah.
And this just adds so much. But obviously, if you're not playing in English, this won't help you a lot.
Yeah, maybe you should.
yeah, I thought about this. It would be really nice if you're playing in an English-speaking setting to maybe even then do it in English as well.
Yeah. There's also a section about secret societies, which I think is really fitting to steampunk settings. And also what you mentioned already with the slang. This is not tied to London specifically, I think.
No, yeah, I think it can be applied everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, simply expressions and words to make you sound more fancy when you're playing an upper-class character, or to make you sound a little more vulgar, maybe, when you're playing a lower-class character. And it works. Like, immediately when I read through these, I was picturing the English gentleman who doesn't ask for something, but he solicits something or something like that. Mm-hmm. I think that's such a nice touch.
This could improve the game a lot. And just having this in there as a basis for whatever character you want to play.
Yeah.
There's also some tips about game mastering itself, like how to create a game together, how to agree on what it should be about, which is always a great idea. I can tell you from experience, it really helps. And how to do that, right? And also, what I think is important, if you play settings that have some sort of historical ties, how to deal with all the social problems that were central to these settings. Do you have to be historically accurate? Or are you allowed to have fun as a player if you play a lower class player character? And I think there are really good tips in there how to deal with that and talk about, do you want to tackle that or not? Do you want to make this a topic? And if not every player wants to have this in the game, don't force it in there just because it historically was in there.
It really depends on what kind of campaign you want to play, who your players are. Obviously, I think that if you have players that are in any way vulnerable or targets of discrimination, just be sensible to that be sensitive to that. And this is also how the author describes basically to deal with these cases here. And I think that's a good side note.
In addition to all these tips on how to create a game, how to GM a game, how to play together, there's also a lot of very handy material on NPCs, stat blocks for persons or creatures you might have in your game. Also, a lot of examples of historical or fictional people that you could have in your game. I think this is a very diverse mixture for different settings,
yeah,
but also very iconic characters. I think he included somewhere in the footnotes, please don't sue. So yeah, I hope that doesn't happen. But having Jules Verne and also Captain Nemo both as characters in years is a great idea, because Jules Verne was also a person at that time. It could be a player character, but at the same time, someone like Captain Nemo or Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde could be player characters.
Yeah, that one I also found particularly funny, that it had both Jules Verne and Captain Nemo in there. But yeah, I can imagine that it works.
And if you didn't get inspired already by all these things, there's still a reading list. This includes writers from that period, also writers from the current age that might write something that can enrich your game or can give you ideas. There's a good mix. I think I already know a lot of these.
I was looking through them a bit. I also know some of them, and I think it's a good selection. I'm on a personal mission to find a book that I had read ages ago, and I thought maybe it's in there because it was also steampunky. I also don't remember a lot about it, only that H.G. Wells was actually a character in the book. If anyone has an idea what this could be, let me know. I would love to find it again. It was really good.
Okay, so there was the ride through the book itself. Any closing thoughts?
As a closing thought, I would say that after reading this, especially after the world building part, I really felt enthusiastic to get back to playing a steampunk campaign. Oh, I would do it entirely different than what we did last time.
Yeah.
It really had the effect that I think it should have on me. I was really inspired. I had a lot of cool ideas. I was immediately picturing like a setting which is a lot grittier than what we used to play, where there is a authoritarian system with a couple of people who have all the steam power in their hand or something like that, and player characters from lower classes who are trying to stand up against that. So after reading this, I was really like, oh yeah, we should do something like this. So I feel like it's done a really good job, this handbook.
Yeah, me too. All in all, I'm really impressed, especially because I already GM'd a steampunk game, a regular game, for quite a while. So this is not the product of someone who just ran a game for a while and then watched a few movies around it and then wrote down what they knew and what they found in game. But this is a lot of stuff that would have eliminated problems in our game before they even came up. There are great thought in that to get a good game going, and so much inspiration. There's so many good ideas in there for the setting. This is really, really great. Okay, let's move on to the whiskey. We are reviewing the Aberfeldy 12 Years, a Highland single malt Scotch whiskey, as it says here on the packaging.
Highland is more something for you, right?
So far, I think so, yes.
Cool.
And I think we agreed on Aberfeldy. I don't know how to pronounce it. I hope that's right.
Aberfeldy, yeah, that's what I thought. But maybe it's also Aberfeldy? I don't really know. Sorry to all the Scots around who are listening to this.
As usual. So, it is a single malt Scotch, as it is often the case when we're reviewing a whiskey here. And
oh, now I get why you chose that. It has something about steam engines on here. The site of our distillery was chosen for its supply of good water and the railway that linked it to Perth. To Perth, okay.
Yeah, Perth, Scotland.
Yeah, I thought so. The Puggy engine brought barley for our maltings and oak for our coopers before conducting the precious golden liquid to market. The Puggy engine resides at the distillery to this day. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I didn't think there was a theme. But obviously that fits.
Yeah, and I think the style of the packaging is also vaguely... Well, steampunk is a bit much, I guess, but it is pretty.
It's definitely pretty.
In black and gold. And gold is a bit of a theme with these because of the river. The, what do you call it? The Pitilly Burn?
Excuse me? Oh, yeah. Pitilly Burn, yeah. I guess.
And this is the river that supplies the water for the distillery, for the whiskey. And it used to carry gold particles, or they used to find gold in there.
I see.
And of course you could argue, this is why the whiskey has this golden color, but I don't think it's that closely related. But it is nicely golden.
It is. It looks really beautiful.
I think the aroma is nice. Slightly fruity, I'd say. Fruity, but not sharp. Maybe a little bit sweet. What do you think?
The smell is a bit fruity, but it doesn't taste so fruity, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. The fruit is entirely in this aroma for me. In the nose, yes.
Yeah. No, but I like it. Now I also get why you said that it's rather mild. The aroma is rather mild, but the taste, not so much, I would say. It's also not super strong. It's definitely not...
Not smoky?
It's not smoky.
Like you love
it? Exactly. No, but I still like this. I can enjoy it. It's not like some other whiskies that I don't like so much. It's still interesting to the tongue.
Okay.
I enjoy it. But I know next to nothing about whiskies. I just like to drink them, so...
That doesn't make you less qualified than I am.
Here's my unqualified opinion. The finish is really... I was about to say comfortable. I don't know if you get what I mean, but it goes down really smoothly, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't linger or scratch or anything. It really just... Yeah. The last sip that I had was a bit too big, I realized, because I felt like I could drink this quite easily, probably.
And then you got to the finish?
No, because of the finish, because it doesn't linger.
Yeah, I think it's comparably short for a finish.
Is it? Oh, so I did say something clever about this.
Well, with the Lagavulin that you usually drink, right? The finish is much longer.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I meant. Like, you have this very long, smoky taste in your mouth that continues to be there after swallowing. And that usually keeps me from having the next sip directly after. But here, that's not so much the case.
You could drink it faster. I don't know if that's an advantage or not.
Depends on how much did you pay for this whiskey.
It was a gift.
Okay, well, it's in that case...
So I got this as a gift, which means I do not know how much it costs. Did you just check for a price tag?
Maybe. I didn't find one, though.
Okay.
So how do we do this? Do you usually then add a dash of water or something fancy like that?
If it was smokier, I would try to add a dash of water or drinking on ice or on whiskey stones. But since it is already that pleasant and sweet, I would skip it. I mean, if you want, you can try adding a dash of water.
No, I think I'm fine. Pleasant is a good word for it, by the way. I think that's exactly how I would describe it.
Aberfaldy also offers longer matured Aberfaldys. I think there's a 16 and 19-year-old version.
Oh, maybe they are stronger then.
Maybe. The distillery also makes blends with this Aberfaldy as a main ingredient. And this one is exclusively matured in oak casks. And the blend that they do, they offer with a bourbon finishing. So after maturing in oak casks, it is put into a bourbon cask and then they let it mature there. But this one isn't. Apparently I missed this. There was one version with a Madeira cask finish. But it was sold out, so I couldn't make any comparisons between this one and the one that is finished in Madeira wine casks again. So,
what is Madeira?
I think it's just wine.
Okay.
Madeira wine. Well, luckily for me, this is whiskey and wildcards and not wine and wildcards. Because while I only have passing knowledge of whiskey, I have very little idea about wine.
Yeah, we always invite other people to drink our wine.
Yeah, that works
perfectly. That works really well, yeah.
So there might be a version available with this finishing, but I didn't get my hands on it.
But is there then also a single malt in the, the Madeira one?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, it's interesting. The blends are in the bourbon and the single is in the Madeira.
Yeah, it's always in oak first.
Okay, and then afterwards in Madeira.
Yeah.
All right.
I suppose it's fine to repeat some of these facts when I remember talking at a party recently with a friend.
I was about to say, I'm learning so much. You know, I can boast of all this knowledge at the next party and seem like super sophisticated. I love this.
Because he was asking like, oh, you also got bourbon whiskey. Is it basically the same or is it made with vanilla? I had to make a few steps back, say, no, it doesn't have anything to do with vanilla. This one is made with maize and this one is made with barley. So it's not just the same thing in different casks, or one is from Kentucky and the other is not. So yeah, this one is made with barley. But this is the characteristic of all Scotch single malts.
Yeah.
They're all made with barley and all matured in oak casks. So nothing particularly special in that case about the Aberfaldy with the oak casks and the barley. I suppose the amount of gold going into it is rather low, but the result is nonetheless of golden color and rather tasty.
Did you see this? That's where your gold is coming from.
Yeah, it just said with coloring.
It was also established in 1846, which again links to a lot of the steampunk settings and stories we've discussed before. So the distillery was established, not the whiskey. That's only 12 years old.
And I think they're doing the 12-year-old since the 90s. I'm not sure if our steampunk gentlemen or the oppressed workers would be seen with a glass of Aberfeldy.
Looking at the Puggy engine, I feel like you could actually make a whole steampunk adventure around this, where the fine gentlemen are drinking the nice whiskey while the exploited laborers have to work in the dirty and dangerous engine to carry the barley to the distillery. And of course, the rich gentlemen don't care about their working conditions at all, but only about their whiskey.
They probably will. So what do steampunk gentlemen drink anyway? Gin?
Good question. Why wouldn't they drink whiskey? Isn't that a thing? Gin maybe as well. I can picture them with whiskey, yeah, certainly. Top hat and whiskey.
So what would you drink this to?
Well, now, after what we just talked about, I would drink it to a top hat celebrating my upper class upbringing. No, I'm just kidding. Of course, I don't want to celebrate that.
So you would say this would be a nice addition to the gentleman's club.
Right.
Or ladies' club. Is there something like a ladies' club?
Oh, you wish.
Well, if we're doing a steampunk setting, I'm sure there'll be a ladies' club.
Thankfully, we can design our steampunk campaign as diverse as we would like.
Yeah, and it's not just ladies having to stay at home and doing embroidery or something like that.
Exactly.
No, but I like this one. It is maybe a bit less smoky and a bit sweeter than the ones that I otherwise would choose, but I think it's really tasty. I hope it wasn't extremely expensive so that I will get another bottle of this once this is finished without breaking the bank.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I would gladly drink another glass of it because mine's already almost empty.
How did that happen?
Seems like the episode is coming to an end.
Okay. So we have to call it a day here. Whiskey is gone from the glasses. In that case, thank you for listening.
Thank you. This was a fun episode.
I was Vasant.
And I am still Lola. Until next time.
So long. Bye.